Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. Welcome. So today we're tackling a giant, really, the tale of Genji. You've given us the sources, and our mission, I think, is to sort of navigate this thousand-year-old text, all that dense cultural context, and really pull out what makes it tick psychologically, philosophically. Why is it so revolutionary?
It's a huge task, you're right. Because it's not just a novel, it's arguably the world's first novel. We're talking early 11th century, somewhere between 1000 and 1012 CE.
That's incredible.
It is. And like you touched on, it's not just the first, but maybe the first psychological novel too, centuries before anything similar popped up in Europe.
Which is just mind-blowing when you think about the author, Murasaki Shikibu. She wasn't some isolated academic. She was right there, a lady-in-waiting in the Hinan Imperial Court.
Mm-hmm. Part of the Fujiwara clan.
Right. And she had this incredible position, this unique viewpoint, and unusually educated too. She knew both the Japanese phonetic script, kana, which was for, you know, poetry and diaries and novels.
The more personal, emotional language.
Exactly. And also the Chinese script, kanji, the formal script for official documents and scholarly work.
And that dual literacy is so important. It meant she could understand both the intimate inner world and the formal outer world of the court. She was perfectly placed to observe it, all the power plays, the subtle emotions, the whole complex system.
You really get a sense of that world she's describing, high and cute, modern Kyoto. It feels so enclosed. Glittering, yes, but very contained.
Totally contained. And the rules were different. It wasn't about brute force or land, like in later periods. It was all about aesthetics. Your worth was literally measured by your taste.
How you dress, the layers of your robes.
Uh-huh. Your handwriting, your skill in poetry, even how well you could blend incense. It was all about refinement, about exquisite presentation.
A world of surfaces.
Absolutely. But, and this is crucial for the novel, underneath all that polish, intense political games, a really rigid social hierarchy, and just simmering forbidden desires. That's the engine of the story.
And that engine is personified in the main character, Hikaru Genji, the Shining Prince. He's supposed to be the absolute peak of the Heian ideal, handsome, incredibly talented, an artist.
A whole package.
But is he really shining?
Yeah.
Reading it, he seems, well, deeply flawed, almost relentlessly obsessive. Is part of the point maybe that the ideal itself is inherently troubled?
Oh, I think that's a fantastic reading. Because his so-called perfection is built on this foundation of deep early trauma. He's the emperor's son, yes, but his mother, Kiritsubo, was a low-ranking consort. Deeply loved by the emperor,
but politically vulnerable.
Exactly. The court jealousies were vicious, and they basically destroyed her. She died young. So to protect Genji from that same fate, the emperor makes this huge decision. He removes Genji from the line of succession, makes him a commoner, gives him the name Genji.
Wow. So right from the start, he's marked by loss and a kind of displacement.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And his whole life becomes this incredibly long, restless search. He's looking for an ideal woman, an ideal love, but it's all fundamentally driven by the loss of his mother. He's chasing her ghost.
A phantom he can never actually grasp.
Never. And this quest, it begins almost immediately with this huge taboo, this foundational transgression. He falls completely, overwhelmingly in love with his stepmother, Empress Fujitsubo.
Who looks like his dead mother.
Who strongly resembles his mother. It's almost Oedipal in its intensity. And that initial forbidden desire really kicks off the whole chain reaction of compromises, affairs, and pursuits that defines his life. It sets the karmic wheel spinning, you could say.
That feels like the absolute core of it. Murasaki Shikibu is putting this question right out there. What are the consequences, spiritual and emotional, when you chase an aesthetic ideal of love, this perfect image, instead of engaging with flawed, messy reality?
And we see those consequences ripple outwards, affecting all the women in his life. Their psychological portraits are just incredibly detailed. Fujitsubo, obviously, is that first unattainable ideal, the mother figure.
Their affair even produces a future emperor, right, Sai, right? In secret.
In secret, yes. And her life becomes this painful struggle between her imperial duty, her piety, and this hidden passion, the secret she has to carry, its torment.
And then there's Lady Rokujo. She's,
yeah.
Well, she's terrifying, frankly, one of the most striking characters.
Absolutely chilling. She's older than Genji, brilliant, proud. But when he neglects her, her humiliation and rage feelings, she just cannot express openly in that society. They become so powerful, they literally manifest
as a vengeful spirit. A Mononoke.
As a Mononoke, yes. A malevolent spirit that attacks and ultimately kills Genji's official wife, Lady Ai. It's an astonishing moment.
It really shows the destructive potential of repressed emotion, doesn't it? especially for women in that court.
Exactly. Murasaki is showing us what happens when intense female feeling has absolutely no acceptable outlet. These women were incredibly cultured, sophisticated, but it had almost zero agency, zero personal freedom.
Their power was all tied up in attracting and keeping a man's attention.
Pretty much, which led to dependence, jealousy, desperation, and in Rokujo's case, something much darker, driven by that powerlessness.
Which brings us to Lady Murasaki. Murasaki no Yue, she's the one Genji kind of grooms.
Well, yes. It's disturbing. He finds her as a young girl, maybe 10 years old. She happens to be Empress Fujitsubo's niece, which is significant. And he essentially takes her, brings her into his household, and educates her, molds her, raises her to be his ideal companion.
His perfect woman, designed by him.
It's a deeply narcissistic project, really. And her life story is one of incredible patience, quiet dignity, but also immense quiet suffering. She becomes the anchor of his household, the stable center he always returns to despite his endless affairs.
But she always knows she was sort of constructed, not chosen for herself.
Exactly. She has to live with that. And it highlights Genji's core flaw. He's so busy searching for the ideal replacement for his mother, this perfect image, that he's fundamentally incapable of truly seeing or valuing the real, complex, imperfect women right there with him.
The structure of the novel seems to really emphasize this journey, this arc of his life. It feels very deliberate, almost like it's teaching us something as it goes.
Oh, definitely. It's paced like life itself, but with clear stages. Part one, roughly the first 21 chapters, that's his youth. It's dazzling. The affair with Fujitsubo, finding and starting to raise young Murasaki, being the absolute star of the court, he seems invincible.
But invincibility doesn't last in this kind of worldview, does it?
Yeah.
Karma's always waiting.
Always. His carelessness eventually catches up. Political rivals seize on an indiscretion, and suddenly he's out. This brings us to part two, Exile, chapters 22 to 33. He chooses self-imposed exile, mainly in Suma and Akashi, remote coastal areas.
A fall from grace.
A huge fall. But it's transformative. Being stripped of his rank, his comforts, the constant aesthetic demands, it forces him to look inward. He starts seriously contemplating Buddhist ideas, karma, impermanence, the nature of suffering, mana no aware.
Yes, mana no aware. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
So exile matures him.
Deeply. He changes from this somewhat careless, almost amoral youth into someone much more reflective. He understands suffering now firsthand.
So he returns, part three, chapters 34 to 41.
Yeah.
And he doesn't just return. He reaches the absolute height of his power and influence, right?
Yeah.
Builds the grand Rokujo estate. He's the elder statesman.
The pinnacle. He has everything. But this is precisely when the karmic justice really lands. The irony is just crushing.
What happened?
For political stability, he agrees to marry the young third princess. This devastates Lady Murasaki, who has been his de facto wife for decades.
Well, that's brutal.
It is. And then the third princess, feeling lonely and neglected herself, has an affair with a young courtier named Kashiwagi, and she becomes pregnant.
No.
Yes. And Genji finds out. And he is forced, publicly, to accept and raise this child, Kaoru, as his own son, knowing full well he isn't the father.
It's the exact echo of what he did with Fujitsubo and Emperor Rightside.
The perfect, painful mirror image. Decades later, the wheel turns, and he has to endure the same secret shame and humiliation he inflicted on his own father. It's profound.
So his later years are marked by this,
this
sense of consequence.
Consequence and loss, relentless loss. The women who defined his life stood to pass away. Most significantly, Lady Murasaki. Her health declines, worn down by years of emotional strain and his neglect, and she dies.
That must break him.
It shatters him completely. He loses his anchor. And in the novel, doesn't give him some dramatic death scene. He just withdraws, seeks religious consolation. And then famously, chapter 42 is just blank.
Titled, Vanished into the Clouds.
Vanished into the Clouds. It's such a poignant, understated ending for him. A whisper, not a shout. Perfectly capturing that sense of impermanence.
But the story doesn't end there, which is also fascinating.
No. Murasaki Shikibu keeps going with the Yuji chapters. The focus shifts entirely to the next generation. Primarily Kaoru, the boy Genji, raised as his son, who is melancholic, deeply conflicted, smelling faintly of an unnatural fragrance.
A symbol of his complex origins?
Perhaps. And Niu, Genji's actual grandson, who is much more passionate, entitled, maybe more like the younger Genji. Their rivalry, particularly over two sisters living in Uji outside the capital, forms the basis of these final chapters.
And is it a happier story?
Not really. It's darker somehow, more filled with indecision, frustration, unresolved tensions. It reinforces that cycle of desire, striving, and inevitable sorrow. The patterns repeat.
Which brings us back to that core concept you mentioned, mononoware. It's thrown around a lot. How would you explain it simply in terms of how it shapes the whole book, not just the mood?
It's often translated as the pathos of things or a sensitivity to ephemera. But it's more than just sadness. It's a deep, almost gentle awareness of the transience of everything, beauty, life, joy, sorrow, like appreciating the cherry blossoms more intensely, precisely because you know they'll be gone tomorrow.
And the novel's structure reflects that. Genji's brilliant rise, his slow decline, the passing of time, the fading of beauty.
Exactly. It embodies mono-aware. It accepts impermanence as the fundamental nature of reality. And linked to that, of course, is karma, or inga. The whole story operates within this Buddhist framework where actions have consequences, often playing out generations later. Genji raising Karu is the prime example.
One last thing we have to touch on is the way people communicate, or rather, don't communicate directly. Those poems, the waka, nearly 800 of them.
They aren't just decoration, they are the dialogue, much of the time.
Why? Why not just speak plainly?
Because in Heian court society, directness, especially about strong emotions or in courtship, was seen as, well, crude. Unrefined, vulgar, almost.
So you wouldn't say, I love you?
Heavens no. You'd compose a perfect little poem, maybe about the moonlight on the dew or the color of a sleeve, and send it via messenger. The poem's skill, its allusions, its tone that conveyed everything. Your sensitivity, your intelligence, your social grace, and the depth of your feeling.
It's a completely coded language.
Completely. The most intense emotional exchanges happen through these incredibly subtle poetic volleys. It forced Murasaki Shikibu to focus on internal states, on unspoken feelings, on the nuances of mood.
Which is the heart of its psychological realism, right? Focusing on the inner life over big external events.
Yeah.
The real drama is internal.
Precisely. That's its revolutionary genius and why it still resonates.
So wrapping this up, what's the enduring takeaway?
I think its enduring power lies in showing that the truly epic stories aren't necessarily about battles and empires. They're about the quiet, intricate, universal struggles within the human heart, the search for connection, for meaning, in a world that is beautiful precisely because it's so fragile.
Yeah, it really forces you to think about that impossible pursuit of perfection. Maybe happiness isn't found in some flawless ideal, but in accepting, even cherishing, the flawed, fleeting, bittersweet reality of life as it passes.
Beautifully put. Embracing the aware in mono no aware.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.